Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, we're going to sample the best in Bay Area philosophical thought with a lineup of world-renowned guests from two of the world's most renowned universities, Stanford and Berkeley.
We're going to stage the radio and philosophical equivalent of one of the Bay Area's premier annual sporting events, the Big Game.
Oh, John, that's not quite right. We're not going to hold a philosophical smackdown. It's more a celebration of the rich intellectual cornucopia that the Bay Area has to offer.
Well, for some people, Ken, the philosophical conversations are like armed combat, or at least an intellectual football game. And the goal is to score debating points. But, of course, that's never been our approach.
That's exactly right, John. We view philosophy as collaborative, not competitive. We see our friends from across the bay as partners rather than rivals in the pursuit of truth and wisdom.
And we especially regard you, our listeners, in the same way. You're our partners. Our partners in shedding light rather than heat on the discussion of issues of both topical and enduring social, cultural, scientific, even spiritual significance.
We've been thinking about these issues together for over 7 years now on KLW. During that time, we've drawn on the great intellectual wealth that the Bay Area has to offer, including from two of our leading institutions of higher learning, and from you, our deeply thoughtful and reflective listeners.
There's another partner that deserves special mention, Ken. This terrific radio station. Without KALW, Philosophy Talk wouldn't even exist.
And all of us. Whether we wear Berkeley's gold and blue, or Stanford's cardinal and white, or the colors of some other school, or no school colors at all, we all owe this fine radio station a debt of gratitude.
When the big game rolls around, our two teams fight to the finish. And we fans have to pony up and choose sides. But when it comes to Philosophy Talk and to supporting KALW, we're all in it together.
Still, John, in keeping with the spirit of this day, I don't suppose that there's any harm in a little lighthearted competition among philosophical friends, is there?
So we'd like to invite you, our listeners, to support your philosophical collaboration with us by helping us to support this jewel of a radio station.
What we'll do is give you a sampler of the best and brightest that both Cal and the Farm have offered over these airwaves.
And what you can do is show pride in your alma mater by donating to this station in your school's name, whether it be Cal, or Stanford, or USF, or Cal State San Jose, or any other of our great Bay Area institutions, or the University of Oklahoma or Nebraska, if that's where you're listening from.
Okay, John, enough with the pregame ceremonies. Let's get out of the way and bring out the combatants.
Here they are, your starting lineups for the Cal-Stanford Philosophical Smackdown of 2010. From Stanford, Provost and philosopher John Etchemedy discussing the very idea of a university.
Representing Berkeley, psychologist Allison Gopnik discussing the minds of babies.
From the Cardinal, psychologist Laura Karstensen discussing aging and the well-lived life.
Also from Stanford, cognitive linguist Lara Boroditsky discussing language and thought.
And from the Bears, that grisly of a philosopher, John Searle, discussing social reality.
The coin is being tossed. Ah, it appears Berkeley gets the ball first.
Cal alum Julie Napolin, our very own roving philosophical reporter, hit the UC campus. There she found someone who embodies something deeply ingrained in the Berkeley ethos, the spirit of political dissent and civil disobedience. She files this report.
It's hard to think of UC Berkeley without thinking of civil disobedience. In 1964, when the university banned all political activity on campus, Mario Savio took his famous stand against censorship before a crowd of 4,000 people, just before being arrested.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part.
The Berkeley campus has changed over the years, and so have the machines. Today, most students milling around campus listen to iPods or talk on cell phones. This makes it hard to hear the free speech coming at them from one local street performer, Stony Burke.
You know, they say this is the melting pot, where the scum rises to the top.
iPod person, come back.
Her iPod's more important.
In 1977, Stony started yelling about politics and daily life on the campus plaza.
I didn't really get radicalized until I got arrested for doing it.
He began performing each week and was arrested more times than he can count. While he was just being uncivil and disruptive, the police continued to arrest him.
In the beginning, it would be something like vagrancy or begging, or, you know, just some kind of hassle thing. And it just kind of reinforced, I think, something very fundamental in me and all of us, that you have to have a person out there talking. No, not blogging, not making a giant movie, not, you know, brandishing a gun, but just somebody talking. Outside, there's no security guards, there's no ticket to get in, you know, it sort of breaks the codes.
Tedford, resign!
When people with headphones walk by, he blows his whistle just outside class windows. That and his bellows disturb classes. The noise is not just disruptive. For Stoney, it's about breaking social codes to demonstrate their injustice.
Whether you're playing a folk song, or whether you're juggling, or whether you've got a three-person comedy group, or a women pop singer, whatever it is on the street, there's so many restrictions, people are really discouraged from doing it.
Sometimes, students crowd around Stoney, and he creates a temporary community free from those restrictions. He hopes students will get so annoyed, they might become more disruptive too.
My whole concept of just get them in a circle. Once you do that, it's all over. They've created their community.
If you'll gather round me, children, a story I will tell.
I guess Woody Guthrie is the closest thing I've ever, that if you could ever get Woody Guthrie into a comedic satiric box, and get, that's what he'd do. He'd travel around, he'd sing his songs about the rights of people.
Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief.
Stoney says his job is to just keep ranting about the rights of people and being as loud as possible until conditions change.
It's a slow thing. You know, it's definitely not a mass media thing. It's something where even in the first time you look at me, you go, oh, who's the homeless guy yelling? This is just what they warned me about in Berkeley. And I think it gives them courage to see when people go on a rant about something that they feel passionate about. You know, we're always told to keep it under control and, you know, keep the, with what little credibility I have flowing through my veins like the Rio Grande, I'll tell you right here, we need to recall all the politicians. That's right, round them up.
Stoney continues to rant and rave. These days, officers walking by pause to give him a stern look and then saunter away.
I'm not invited here. No one said, Stoney, you can be here. A list of arrests would back up the fact that they really don't want you here. On the other side, I try to train myself to get in, you know, the dream of having a revolution.
We're still waiting, we're waiting on the world to change.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Julie Napolin.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
We're taking a philosophical look at two Bay Area alma maters, Stanford and UC Berkeley.
We just heard our roving philosophical reporter talking to a subversive voice on the Berkeley campus. Well, there's another very subversive idea going around these days, that universities need to be radically altered, that things like tenure are relics of a bygone past.
Two recent books, Andrew Hacker's Higher Education, How Colleges Are Wasting Our Money and Failing Our Kids, and Mark C. Taylor's Crisis on Campus, A Bold Plan for Reforming Our Colleges and Universities, they both make the case against the traditional university.
But before either of these controversial books was published, we recorded a program on the Stanford campus during Alumni Week. We discussed the very idea of a university with Stanford provost and philosopher John Etchemendy.
Let's listen to that now.
What I say is the mission of Stanford University, and I actually think if you look at mission statements of any of universities that have such things, you'll find that they're all very similar. But the mission of the university is the creation, preservation, and proliferation of knowledge, or transmission of knowledge, for the benefit of all. Now, that basically pulls in everything that we do. The creation of knowledge, that is the research, right? Preservation of knowledge, well, preservation of knowledge, of course, is in part the libraries and museums and so forth and so on that we have, but much more important is transferring that knowledge to the next generation. And the transmission of knowledge is the education function.
That all sounds very good, you know, but it doesn't have much bite yet because there's lots of knowledge out there that we could create, preserve, and transmit. Then we have to make hard choices about which knowledge, right, to whom. I mean, how does the mission statement of the university drill down and help us
understand which knowledge we're supposed to be trying to create, knowledge where, about what, right? And then transmit to whom? How do we decide those questions?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's which knowledge, any knowledge. I mean, knowledge is very broad, and the university is very broad. And one of the things about a university is that universities, if they're not going to die, grow. And the reason they grow is because the fields of knowledge expand. I mean, as we know more, a university has to expand. So, no, I wouldn't want to say you choose a subset of the areas.
Well, so, I mean, so if we went back, you know, the university is a really old thing, right? It goes way back. I mean, Plato's Academy, the medieval university, universities in the 19th century, the German university, it's a very old thing. I mean, and the branches of knowledge wither and die and grow. And what is the university's role in sort of helping that or making that happen? I mean, do we just do that ourselves?
In other words, can you give us some really good reason to have a philosophy department? Yeah,
philosophy is the queen of the sciences. You know that.
Or any given department. What justifies the inclusion of it?
I actually think that the departments come and less frequently go. So if you looked at the history of human knowledge, there are as areas become more clearly understood, they become disciplines of their own. So psychology came out of philosophy about 150 years ago. Computer science came out of philosophy about 50 years ago. Physics came out of philosophy about 1,000 years ago. And so forth and so on. Yeah. But new disciplines appear, new departments appear. Do departments go away? Sometimes they do, and sometimes they do prematurely. Many universities got rid of geography departments about 50 years ago, and actually the field of geography has actually had a resurgence thanks to geographical information systems, and so they probably think that we should have kept that geography department.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, recorded live at Stanford's Reunion Homecoming Week. Our guest is Provost John Etchemendy.
What is the mission of a university, and to whom does it answer? The students, the trustees, all of society, which society? America, the whole world, the world of people, or the world of knowledge and truth in the abstract?
John, I was an undergraduate at Notre Dame, and I've read Cardinal John Henry Newman's idea of a university. He thought of the university as in service of the divine, as helping us get knowledge of truth and beauty, ultimately in connection to the divine. Okay, but let's think. Who does a secular university like Stanford serve? Does it serve its faculty? Does it serve its students? Does it serve society at large? Does it serve the board of trustees? Who do we serve? To whom do we answer?
I think the answer is simple. Society. Society, or at risk of sounding sort of overblown, civilization. I think that is the clear answer. And it serves students, it serves faculty, but the service of the university is to the society.
How exactly does that work? I mean, you could serve society. I mean, society has, like, concrete needs. We're not going to balance the budget. We're not going to, some of our colleagues may discover a cure for cancer, but you know, society at large doesn't care about me sitting in my office writing the great works of philosophy, right? I hope, you know, I know you guys do, but the society at large, Ken Taylor writing philosophy, what social good is that? Because we don't solve the concrete day-to-day problems.
No. Well, I actually think that's not quite true, Ken. We serve society by advancing knowledge. The knowledge eventually becomes applied, sometimes very quickly, sometimes less quickly, and that can be in the form of, you know, developing an MRI machine. The universities developed the technology that led to MRI machines, microwaves, et cetera, and that eventually becomes in service to our lives, right? And it becomes in service to the country. It's in service to the economy of the country. It's also in service to individuals' lives. Obviously, medical research. How about the education? The education, it is in the interest of our society that we have an educated populace. It is the one and only way that we can transfer the knowledge of civilization to the next generation. And if we don't do that, that knowledge will go away and civilization will be diminished.
A rousing defense of the very idea of a university by Stanford University Provost and philosopher John Etchemendy.
Speaking of rousing, John, you know, my alma mater was Notre Dame. And one of the things I remember most about my college days was the spirit of the place. There was just nothing like being in an otherwise dreary, and I do mean dreary, South Bend, Indiana in late November on a Notre Dame football Saturday.
Well, Ken, my alma mater was Little Doane College in Crete, Nebraska. We Doane Tigers knew a thing or two about school spirit, too. You know, Ken, I was on the football team at Doane. I was starting left bench.
Well, we want you, our listeners, to get off the bench and show your school spirit. Please get into the spirit of giving to KALW, the fine radio station that allows philosophy talk to be in the game.
As we get back to the action at the Cal-Stanford Philosophical Smackdown, we're going to turn to the fastest-talking color commentator on public radio, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I was a supporter of my high school basketball team. I even joined the Glee Club briefly before I realized I had not glee within me. As soon as I graduated, however, my school spirit evaporated, never to return. When I was in graduate school in Iowa City, its citizens every fall succumbed to a phenomenon called Hawkeye fever. Alumni would descend upon the town in black and gold outfits, driving black and gold vehicles, blowing air horns, holding parades, thrilling for participants, alarming to me. We've always been a nation of cheerleaders, especially in small towns. Sinclair Lewis mocked the booster mentality in his novel Babbitt, and before that, he depicted small-town America as a little pit of backbiting hypocrites in Main Street, supposedly based on his hometown of Sauk Center, Minnesota. Despite being dissed by its home son, Sauk Center every summer hosts Sinclair Lewis Days, which include waffle breakfast, ice cream socials, softball tournaments, cook-offs, and bargains galore. Babbitt would have loved it. When you're a booster, you see, a smile is a frown turned upside down. Now small towns are in trouble, and the booster spirit is moving into survival mode. Standish, Michigan, around 1,500 people, offered to take in Gitmo detainees. Sitka, Alaska, population around 9,000, has plenty of fresh water and wants to export some of it to India. Playas, New Mexico, has rebirthed itself as a go-to site for war on terror combat simulations. It calls itself Terror Town. In Purley, Texas, population 200 or so, its residents decided to erect the world's largest fiberglass chili dog in order to be known as the chili dog capital of the world. Lombard, North Dakota, is the crabapple capital of the world. Gainesville, Georgia, is the chicken capital of the world. Middleborough, Massachusetts, is the cranberry capital of the world. Still, despite every effort, small towns die. The mill shuts down, the mine plays out, the factory is outsourced, chickens get salmonella. Cranberry bogs get infested with malaria-bearing mosquitoes. The demand for crab apples withers. Then the high schools close, barber shops, restaurants, churches, and finally, the bars. Take picture Oklahoma. Its lead mines provided the bullets for World Wars I and II. Those mines shut down in 1970. Then ground contamination and the threat of cave-ins forced the citizens to evacuate. Already one of the most toxic places in the U.S., a tornado in 2008 leveled half of what was left and pretty much assured that nobody would ever live in the area again. Federal monies were provided for relocation. And yet, in these dire straits, one of the final acts of the town of Pitcher was to donate $578,000 to Northeast Oklahoma's A&M College, the largest gift in the history of the school. Was this pure foolishness? Well, A&M began life as the Oklahoma School of Mines. In return for the gift, the college will house and store thousands of historical documents from the mining town of Pitcher. So, in one donation, you see both school spirit and boosterism. Pride for a ghost town, sinking into the stolen Indian ground from which it rose, poisoned, never to return. Rah, rah, fight, fight, I gotta go.
A personal take on school spirit from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher. This is Philosophy Talk, and today we're sampling some of our favorite moments on the program to show what great universities and great public radio can do together.
Whether you're a fast-talking philosopher or just a part of the rich intellectual community in the Bay Area, we need your help to keep this program and the wonderful KALW on the air. Here's what to do. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Each week we question everything except the Bay Area's intelligence.
Today we're having great fun bringing you the first annual Cal-Stanford Philosophical Smackdown, a chance to show off some of the intellectual contributions of the two major universities in the Bay Area.
Quite often we perform the program live at the Mars Theater in the Mission in San Francisco and just off campus at Berkeley. It's a chance for us to meet some of our listeners up close and personal.
These live recordings also give us Stanford types an opportunity to connect with some of our UC Berkeley colleagues, especially in disciplines beyond philosophy.
Like psychologist Allison Gopnik, who joined us for a program recorded live at the Marsh in San Francisco entitled From the Minds of Babies. She argues that young children's minds are anything but a blooming, buzzing confusion. She says that babies are in many ways more conscious than adults.
Well, actually, Ken, at both Cal and Stanford, you see some students who seem to think consciousness is overrated.
I'm not touching that one, John.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the minds of babies. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our guest is Allison Gopnik, author of The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life.
So, Allison, you advertise in your book, you know, that babies' minds are key to helping us understand some longstanding philosophical puzzles and quandaries about mind and self and all that. Give me your favorite example from your book of what studying babies helps us understand.
Well, let's take some of the questions about empiricism and nativism. One of the deepest questions in philosophy has always been, how can we find out the truth about the world? After all that comes to us from the world are photons hitting the back of our retina and little disturbances of air at our right. ears, and yet all of us live in a world of chairs and tables and people and quarks and photons and distant planets. How do we ever get, and we think that's true, how do we ever get there from here? Well, what we've started to discover, really, just even in the past 10 years, is that babies have extremely powerful learning mechanisms, very powerful capacities for things like probabilistic induction, the sort of things that philosophers of science have talked about, very sophisticated scientists doing. Now, babies do all this unconsciously, not consciously, but they can use some of the same kinds of techniques for looking at patterns of probability in the world and inferring the way the world works that we see in science and we see in very sophisticated machine learning. Let me give you a practical example. Maybe an impractical example. This is work that my colleague Fei Xu at Berkeley has done. So what she did was she showed babies a box full of ping pong balls. This is the classic philosophical urn. In philosophy, it's always an urn. So she showed them an urn full of ping pong balls, 80% white, 20% red. And then, this was with nine-month-old babies, she showed them an experimenter who either took four white and one red ball out of the box, or took four red and one white ball out of the box. Now, if the baby's thinking like a philosopher, then she should think that that second sequence, four red and one white, although it's possible, is very improbable given the nature, the statistical nature of the urn. And sure enough, that's exactly what nine-month-olds thought. Nine-month-olds looked much longer at the possible but improbable event than at the more likely one.
Right.
So these tiny babies already implicitly were using principles about randomness, about selection, the kinds of things that we would use if we were very sophisticated.
You have another
scientists.
Book called The Scientist in the Crib, in which you talk about how babies are little scientists. And I mean, I think this is a deeply important point, because go back to what we said about language and how rapidly and effortlessly kids seem to acquire language. That convinced people like Chomsky that right. it was already all in there and there wasn't really much of a learning problem, because if it were a learning problem, given the meager data they had to work on, it would be impossible.
Exactly.
He thought statistical regularities couldn't possibly do it. But this new kind of work you're talking about, I think it's really eye-opening, because it gives you... You don't have to be a full-blown Chomskyan nativist, and you don't have to be a naive empiricist.
Right.
The babies' minds are really complicated learning machines.
Exactly. So I think we're getting to a place which isn't just a sort of, you know, wishy-washy compromise between nativism and empiricism. What we're actually starting to say is, here's what babies start out knowing, here's the learning mechanisms that they're born with, and the amazing thing is that you put those two things together, and you can learn the incredible range of things that human beings can learn.
And we've got lots of questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm Andrea from San Francisco.
Okay.
So you're talking about babies having an incredible ability to learn and absorb, and I really like the language as an example. It's very hard for me to sit down and learn a new language in a couple of months. So maybe you don't know the answer to this question, but what happens to us after we're babies? Right. Why do we lose this ability to learn so well?
Excellent question.
Yeah, this is the, if babies are so smart, why are we so stupid? question. And in fact, one of the interesting things about babies is that we have childhood and babyhood at all. An interesting evolutionary question. Why are we so helpless, so immature, so useless for such a long period of time?
Does any other animal, creature have anything like our childhood as a proportion of their life compared to us?
No, that we're way off on the end of the distribution in how immature we are for how long. And of course, at Berkeley, we're even further.
Yeah.
But the moral of that is a good moral, which is that it also turns out that the longer the period of immaturity of a species, the smarter, the more flexible, the more that species depends on learning as an adult.
I mean, one of the things you say in your book, which I really like, but in some ways it's kind of startling. I don't think you quite put it this way, but babies and grown-ups are, in a way, different kinds of animals.
Exactly.
Right? It's like we're two species in one, because as grown-ups, we got to stay on task, we got to stay focused, right? And all this wandering attention, the seizable attention that babies exhibit, would be ruinous, because I know this myself, because I haven't got it for our adult lives, but being like an adult as a baby would be ruinous for your task of trying to figure out who you are, where you are. Right.
Exactly. So one of the things I say is that it's like the transition from caterpillars to butterflies, except they're the butterflies who get to flutter around and explore, and we're the caterpillars who have to hump along our little narrow adult path. So the answer to the question is the kind of intelligence that we need as adults to be able to, say, do long-term planning, imagine our future goals, save up for our lives, and very importantly, take care of those babies, have enough resources to keep those babies going. That kind of intelligence isn't the kind of intelligence that would be the best for learning as many new things as possible.
Well, if you think about it, we go around and each decision we make, we have to take account not just of what we're conscious and aware of, but this tremendous structure that we've got in our minds of, you know, IRAs and retirement and what's Obama going to do and what's my children going to do and what's the traffic light and what's the weather going to be. So we only have a little bit of room left to really pay attention to what's happening. And a point you make in the book is that's not true with babies. And so in a way, they're much more conscious than we are.
That's right. So I think, to be fair to grown-ups, part of the reason why we have so much trouble learning new things is because we already know so much.
Right.
And very rationally, as grown-ups, mostly we depend on what we already know.
That's my big problem in philosophy. I seem to know so much that I have hard relating to
on that note of modesty, let's take another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Josh. I'm from San Francisco. And I'd like to ask you to get back to the nativism question, mm-hmm. if you would. You said that babies come equipped with capacities for learning and also with this intuitive sense of other minds. Mm-hmm. Are there other components that mm-hmm. that also come inbuilt?
Yeah. So we think that babies are born, for instance, knowing a lot about the physical structure of the world or having some ideas about the physical structure of the world. Things like how objects go behind one another, mm-hmm. how objects work, how they move. Those are all things that babies seem to be born at least having first pass hypotheses about, just like they have first pass hypotheses about what other people are like. But they're also born with these abilities for probabilistic reasoning and for statistics and for experimenting. And that means that they can change those things that they start out thinking. Again, very much like scientists.
It's Philosophy Talk. We called the episode From the Minds of Babies with Allison Gopnik from UC Berkeley.
You're listening to the Cal Stanford Philosophical Smackdown of 2010. It's our version of the big game, only this one uses brains instead of brawn.
Allison and her team at Berkeley are disproving the idea that babies and young children are simply cognitive blank slates. Meanwhile, down at Stanford, there's another psych lab that's investigating the minds of seniors.
Laura Carstensen directs the Stanford Center on Longevity. She joined us for a program recorded at the Classic Residence by Hyatt, a senior living community not far from Stanford.
We called the program Aging and the Well-Lived Life.
Beliefs in the general public and in the scientific community, too, that aging is simply a downward, intractable spiral are wrong, and a great barrier to thinking creatively and productively about flourishing and aging.
Have we always thought of aging that way? I mean, has it changed how people have thought of aging? You know, so philosophers like to use the notions like socially constructed, that the very concept of aging might be a socially constructed category. So it might vary from culture to culture and time to time. What do you think?
Well, our stages of life are clearly social constructions. There's nothing magic about 65, you turn old. And so we make these things up. But I think we're particularly confused about old age because old age, if you will, is young. It's new in the history of humankind.
What do you mean by that?
Well, through most of human evolution, life expectancy was about 27. And then it inched up in 1800s. It was kind of in the mid-30s. And then in 1900 in the United States, life expectancy was 47. And by the end of that century, life expectancy was 77.
But people were always living into their 80s and 90s, weren't they? It was just that the average was brought down by all the infant mortality and disease that took teenagers and young people.
It's exactly right that much of the increase in life expectancy comes from saving the lives of the youngest in the population. But life expectancy has increased at all ages across the last 100 years. And there weren't very many old people. So even though you're right, there have been old people since, you know, whenever we can record history. But for example, in the United States, in 1900, 4% of the population was over 65. So to be blunt, when 4% of the population is a certain group, any group, whatever it is, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter that much
so
what they're like.
So the category of the old up until recently just was not a very sort of socially prominent,
yeah.
socially consequential category?
From the perspective of society, it wasn't that relevant.
That's kind of frightening because since I got old enough to get into the theater half price, I've been really enjoying it. But if all of a sudden there's going to be all these older people, they'll put the prices back up.
Okay, so the emergence of the category of the old, that's a 20th century thing.
As a normative stage in life, yes.
Let me ask you a little bit different question. Now, given that there's always been old people, even though not so many, it raises the question to a scientist like yourself, why? I mean, there aren't old dogs. Why did evolution make us such that some of us, and increasingly more of us, live so old? Do we actually perform any function? Most of us quit reproducing a long time ago.
Wait a minute. There are dogs that are old for dogs.
Yeah. But,
but that's a good question. That's a good. I go back to the John's real question. It's an excellent question.
You know, there's a philosopher, historian of aging, Thomas Cole, and he says that one of the greatest challenges before us now is to try to figure out what old age is for, mm-hmm. now that we've received it. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some people who think old age as a normative stage is just a byproduct of young people surviving past those early critical years, and there's really nothing about old age that's anything except leftover years. But there's some reason to think that older people in a population have a lot to contribute to their offspring and their offspring's ability to keep their genes in the gene pool. It's called the grandmother hypothesis, and some people think that's actually why humans get old.
But wait a minute.
Grandfathers don't have anything to do with it?
You know, as it turns out, they don't.
Oh, my gosh.
It's an interesting story about why. And this is true not just for humans, but it's true for vervet monkeys and lions and some other mammals. The presence of a grandmother increases the likelihood that a grandchild will survive. Mm. Kristen Hawkes, an anthropologist, has done some observational work in hunting and gathering societies in Africa today. And the observation is this, you know, the women go out and gather, and after the second child is born, you see a peak in gathering in the grandmother. She's taking care of the older child because the mother is now paying more attention to the new infant. And the presence of a grandmother increases the likelihood that that infant will survive. So some people think that's why we continue to see older people. And that's also why humans are as smart as they are, because the grandmother's knowledge helps the survival of the offspring.
So basically, all the advice that mothers-in-law get grief for giving their daughters-in-law and sons-in-law isn't so bad.
It's keeping them alive.
It's keeping them alive. But so tell me briefly, I feel as a male, I feel kind of left out of this story.
You want to know
why is it that we're just a byproduct?
So I had lunch with Kristen Hawkes a few years ago, and I asked her that question because it didn't make a lot of sense to me. And in fact, if you look at gathering, males gather more than females at any age. So males are gathering too. And I said, why wouldn't it matter? You know, what about the grandfathers? And she said, the grandfathers don't share.
Laura Carstensen from the Stanford University Center on Longevity, discussing aging and the well-lived life.
We're sharing some of our favorite episodes of Philosophy Talk with scholars from our two great Bay Area universities, Stanford and the University of California at Berkeley. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. To help ensure that we can keep listening to Philosophy Talk, KALW needs your support.
Ken, think of the historic moments in the Stanford-Cal rivalry. On Stanford's side, there were the great years of Don Bunce, the philosophy major quarterback, and Jim Plunkett. From the Cal side, everything pales in comparison to the big play where Berkeley scored the winning touchdown against the Stanford band.
This is your chance to make history again on behalf of your school, whatever your alma mater. Here's how.
I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. It's the Cal-Stanford Philosophical Smackdown of 2010, a sampling of some of the best of our show featuring friends from Stanford and UC Berkeley.
On October 17th, we're going to start a new series of 8 live programs at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco and in Berkeley. One of our guests will be an old friend of the show, Stanford psychologist Lara Boroditsky.
Lara has written provocatively about the relationship between language and thought.
Like any psycholinguist worth her salt, she's got a wealth of data, experiments, and studies at her fingertips.
She treated us to a few choice cases.
One of my favorite examples comes from an Aboriginal group in Australia that Steve Levinson and his colleagues have been studying. They study people who have a very interesting property of their language. They don't have words like left and right, and sometimes not even forward or back. And instead, they express everything in terms of cardinal directions, things like north, south, east, west. Now, the consequence of having a language like this is that you have to end up saying things like, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or move the cup to the northeast. And in order to speak a language like this, you have to stay oriented. Otherwise, you can't speak the language.
Yeah, right.
So I don't want to ask you guys which way southeast is now, because you probably don't know. We're sitting in this studio. You've probably been here many times. Oh, I can see people pointing in all directions. The point is, to speak a language like that, you have to stay oriented. There's no other way to speak it.
How do you say you're left? Can you say I'm left-handed in such a language?
So there are lots of languages like this. In some languages, there will be words for different sides of the body, but they're very infrequent. They're kind of like words like ventral and dorsal in English, or you have words like that, but you don't really use them.
My guess is that these people are outdoors a lot and that the skies are fairly clear, but
You know, these languages happen all around the world, and these people stay oriented when they're indoors without being able to see the sky. And there are lots of people who live outdoors who don't have languages like this.
So much for my guess.
How do they stay oriented? They just know? How do they do that?
Well, what they do, actually, their ability.
I mean, the language doesn't enable them to do that. They need to do that in order to be able to use the language, right?
The language requires them to pay attention to and keep reorienting wherever it is they are. So the language forces them to attend to an aspect of the world that you and I don't attend to because we don't have to.
Right. Except if we're on a boat or trying to follow directions, and then it's hard for us because we don't have any kind of built-in mechanisms, socially conditioned mechanisms or something like that.
Well, the mechanism, we have the latent capacity to be able to attend to such things. We just don't develop it, whereas these folks do. In fact, before these folks were discovered, we thought that humans didn't have this ability. We would study navigation in ants and birds and so on, and thought that birds and ants were actually better than us at navigating. But it turns out humans do have this capacity. It's just not developed.
Now, is that a universe? But no, okay, let's think about the relativity thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so most of us don't have a language that requires us to develop that capacity, to exploit that capacity. But you just suggested that we do have that capacity. And
maybe it's like this, you know, languages, because of the sparseness of language. I mean, you and John agreed that language is sparse, and that seems right to me. Because of the sparseness of language, and it exploits some things, and some language may exploit some things and not exploit other things, well, you'll find a difference. I think in one of your articles I read something about thinking for speaking, right? You'll find a difference of what this language requires you to exploit in order to speak it and use it successfully, right? But the capacities may be universal. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by capacity. By capacity, all you mean is everything that humans in the world have ever learned is in principle learnable. Then yes, but that's a kind of a trite statement. Yes, we're all born being able to more or less learn things that humans around the world have managed to learn. The question is, what is it that you actually learn? And what kinds of mental representations do you actually form and use? There's no question about whether or not these folks stay oriented or not. I was just at an Aboriginal community in Australia this summer, and they thought I was extremely stupid because I couldn't remember, within 3 degrees of error, as you're supposed to, which way was which.
Are there other, I mean, so we've got the left and the right and over there, over here. Are there other kind of things that we usually convey with indexicals and demonstratives, like up and down or me and you, that there are some languages that just don't encode? Is there some language where you just have names and you don't have me and you and I and they?
There are languages that differ a lot in the kinds of pronouns that they have. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely differences in pronouns. One of my favorite differences is between languages like English and Indonesian. In Indonesian, there's an inclusive we and an exclusive we. So if I were to turn to Ken and say, we're going to go and have a cup of coffee afterwards, I could choose to use the inclusive we that includes all of us, or I could choose to use the exclusive we that includes only me and Ken and not you, John.
I like that. Well, let's leave John out here. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about language and thought with Lara Boroditsky from Stanford University, and Jill in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jill.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm just so happy to hear this topic, because in high school I studied German and it never really occurred to me this idea, but then in college when I started learning Japanese, the idea that culture could shape the language became very clear to me, because sentence structures and even just the types of words chosen to convey certain thoughts seemed so obvious that they had been influenced by the different culture, the way the language was shaped. And so just to know that people are studying this makes me very happy, because it proves how smart I am.
So did you want to raise a question, or you just want to congratulate yourself?
idea was definitely that the culture was shaping the language more than the other way around.
Well, it depends on what you mean by culture. I think language is a part of culture. So there are things that we share socially among people. So language is one constituent of culture. To me, it doesn't make sense to say, is it language that shapes thought or is it culture that shapes thought? One is a part of the other. You could ask, is it language or some other non-linguistic part of culture that shapes thought? And I think both are true.
That was Stanford psychologist Lara Boroditsky discussing the relationship between language and thought. It's the first annual Cal Stanford Philosophical Smackdown, our version of the big game pitting the two intellectual powerhouses against each other.
Universities are complicated places, John. You know, it takes a whole lot of people to make them work.
I guess universities are a part of social reality.
Well, Berkeley might be accused of being socialist. Well, I wouldn't say that about Stanford.
I didn't say socialist. I said social.
You mean social as in public? Stanford's a private university, John, not a public one.
Even private universities are social, Ken.
Well, our students are a pretty social bunch, but, you know, I don't think they socialize nearly as much as Berkeley students do. I mean, after all, Palo Alto's kind of, let's face it, boring.
I don't mean social as in socializing. I mean social as in collectively constituted, created by agreements among people rather than existing independently of us.
Oh, that kind of social reality.
Right. They're the kinds of things we discuss with Berkeley's John Searle.
There is an overriding question in philosophy, and that is, how does the world hang together? How does money, property, government, and marriage relate to thoughts and feelings, and how do they relate to biology and evolution, and how do they relate to physics? So the big question is, to put it very simply, how do you get from protons to presidents, from electrons to elections? How is it possible that we human beings construct an objective reality that only is what it is because that's what we think it is? So everything hangs together in a way that we need to show. But secondly, there's a special paradox we need to resolve, and that is institutional reality of money, property, government, and marriage. They only exist because we think they exist, and yet they're objective. This stuff in my pocket, it's really money. That's an objective fact. How can it be if it's just a matter of human agreement? That's the question I was trying to answer in this book.
Okay, so I'm going to reread your 20 books with this unity in mind.
Okay, but read fast because I'm working on two more.
Okay. But now, just with respect to social reality, Ken and I were discussing the many forms of social reality. Is there an underlying unity beneath all this diversity?
There is. I think we're not smart enough to use a whole lot of different gimmicks to create a social reality. But if you're talking about institutional reality, where you have cocktail parties and universities and governments and private property and marriage, there's a single device we use. And not surprisingly, it's a form of speech act. We represent things as existing. And thus, under special circumstances, you can create a reality by representing it as existing. Money is created by a certain kind of a set of speech acts, but that doesn't just represent the piece of paper as money, it makes it money.
So it's like we say, let there be money, and there is money, and we've spoken truly because we've made it true.
Exactly, right.
But you used a phrase I want you to clarify. You talked about institutions. That sounds like the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
But then you referred to cocktail parties. What institutions are there with cocktail parties?
Okay. Now, whenever you have an established procedure for doing something, you have a set of expectations. These may be heavily formalized, like the Congress of the United States, or there may be the most informal thing, a practice of having a beer party on Friday night. In both cases, people have sets of expectations, and those expectations are not just suppositions that something's likely to happen. They think they're entitled to things happening. And to say that is to say that there's a certain structure to the creation of those entities, and I need a word for that. I call those entities institutions, even though that goes beyond the ordinary meaning of the word. But whenever you get a situation where you can make something the case by representing it as being the case, I call that an institutional fact.
UC Berkeley's John Searle on Social Reality, recorded live at the Marsh in Berkeley. Our next live series at the Marsh starts October 17th.
It's Philosophy Talk, and we've been listening back to some of our favorite shows with guests from two great Bay Area universities, the University of California at Berkeley and our very own Stanford. We call it the Cal-Stanford Philosophical Smackdown.
Lots of KALW listeners are cheerleaders of sorts for their alma mater, whether it's Berkeley, Stanford, or some other college.
But no one does a college cheer faster than Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
UC Berkeley's not my pal. I'm from Stanford. Go to hell. Stanford does not have a rhyme, as the thing says, clobberin' time. You're the Bears and we're the Cardinal. The pain we bring will be abominable. UC Berkeley is a turkey. You can call your team the Bears, still a turkey. We don't care. Stanford, Stanford, we will bring you discord. We be UC. KLW, that's our station. Finest radio in the nation. Donate now. Rah, rah, rah.
Ian Scholes leading the cheer for the Stanford Cardinal, the Cal Bears, and KALW.
We at Philosophy Talk feel privileged to be part of the quality programming at KALW. But the only way the station can continue to bring you these thought-provoking discussions is with your help.
Every listener, any amount, makes a difference. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for supporting your local public radio station.
Here's how.